Welcome to the CRE Exchange Podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of CRE professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in the space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research here at Altus Group, a leading provider of asset and fund level intelligence. I'm joined by Omar Eltzrai, our U.S. Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. Omar, it's great to be with you. What do we got on our agenda today?
First, we'll start off with some macro releases, including GDP, inflation, manufacturing, housing, and construction. And then we'll get into some of the issues that we've been following. That are either in policy, politics, or ultimately are affecting the economy. Then we'll touch on some of the market data that we've seen recently, and then we'll close it out with some retail updates from earnings calls and Black Friday data that we've seen, and we'll end the call with our regular announcements.
All right. Well, how about you kick us off with what you're watching in macro releases?
Certainly. So on November 27th, there were three major economic releases. The first was from the Bureau of Economic Analysis when they published their personal income and outlays release. This contained the personal consumption expenditure data, or PCE, for the month of October. And as a reminder, PCE is really seen as the Fed's preferred inflation measure, and it rose 0.4% on a monthly basis, or 2.3% year-on-year through October, which is up from the 2.1% year-on-year pace in September. The annual growth rate for core PCE, which removes energy and food, moved up to 2.8% in October, and that's up from 2.7% annual rate in September. While both of these measures, headline and core, were in line with expectations, they do show that price pressures still remain in the system. And well above expectations of economists was the personal income data, which it showed that personal incomes rose 0.6% in October over the prior month, potentially indicating that there's still some more stick to the stickiness, because if people are making more, and they can afford to spend more, which can ultimately fuel more inflation. The second big release that came out on the 27th, also released by BEA, was the second estimate of U.S. Q3 GDP, which was unrevised and so was kept at an annual growth rate of 2.8%. And while the headline estimate didn't move, the estimate for personal consumption was revised down modestly by 0.2%. to an annual growth rate of 3.5% from the prior quarter. And this really shows that the economy is continuing to hum along and still is expansionary. And then the final release that I'd call out here is the ISM Manufacturing PMI, which was released on the same day, November 27th. The release showed that the index increased to 48.4 in November, and this is up from 46.5 in October, which was an improvement and was above forecasts. But with this index, you got to remember that the number you're trying to hit is 50, and anything below 50 means that you're still in contractionary phase. While the reading shows that manufacturing does continue to contract, it's doing so at a moderating pace. So that's kind of a silver lining. But components of the index also showed that new orders and production rebounded while employment and inventories declined, but at a moderating pace. Price pressures and deliveries were noted in the release as improving, though the commentary in the release also mentioned that demand overall remains weak. Now, all of these indicators together are ultimately used as an input, one of my favorite indicators that's out there, and that's the Atlanta Fed's GDP Now, which is a forecast of real economic annualized growth. GDP Now was updated to show that the forecast for real GDP growth in the fourth quarter is expected to be 3.2%. So that's an annualized growth rate. And that's up from 2.7% just before these data points came out. And so that's a substantial jump and ultimately contributed to a rather impressive GDP forecast for the fourth quarter. And Cole, I know you were looking at a number of other macro releases that came out. What were you seeing?
Yeah, so these came out in that period before Thanksgiving as well, but I was paying attention to construction and housing data. So we got quite a few data points to talk through here, but the first one released on November 26th. So the Federal Housing Finance Agency released data on home prices for the third quarter 2024. And they showed that prices rose 4.3% over the year prior and up 0.7% from the second quarter. This is all seasonally adjusted. And there was a nice quote from their division of research that the price growth did slow in the third quarter, and that's a trend that's continued through the fourth quarter of the previous year. And so house prices continue to increase. Housing demand has outpaced the locked-in housing supply. High mortgage rates, elevated home prices are actually now slowing home price growth. But on the same day, and this typically happens each quarter, we got the U.S. CoreLogic S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index. It's important to know the difference between these two. The FHFA House Price Index only includes FHA-backed mortgages. So the Case-Shiller is actually more inclusive of the upper end of the housing stock. So it can be a bit more volatile because it's more inclusive of the set of home sales. But the year-over-year growth for the Case-Shiller index fell to 3.9%. And that's actually down from a high in February and March of 2024 of 6.5% this year. And so the other important thing to note here was that according to this index, houses are officially 51% more expensive than at the start of the pandemic. And the typical mortgage payment is now 82% up from the start of the pandemic. So some remarkable figures over the past 4 years. Almost 5 years now, I guess. But the other piece of data we got is interesting to pair with this. So the Census Bureau and Department of Housing and Urban Development release new home sale data. This is just newly built homes, not existing homes. The release showed that in October 2024, there were 610,000 new home sales at a seasonally adjusted annual rate. This is 17.3% below the revised September rate of 738,000 and 9.4% below a year prior, so October 2023, where the estimate was 673,000. The number of new homes for sale at the end of October, again, seasonally adjusted annual rate, 481,000. That actually represents 9.5 months of supply. But the interesting thing there, since a lot of the demand for housing has been channeled into the new housing market, because the existing home market is so frozen, that is actually way more supply and the highest we've seen since July of 2022. So I think there's some interesting implications for our world here, for multifamily in particular. The demand fundamentals seem to be there for multifamily because the new and existing home sale markets, while improving, are still relatively frozen. Home prices remain super elevated. Price discovery is a bit troubled in that market as well. And so really, really interesting implications for multifamily, generally speaking. But I did want to call out one other number. So we got construction spending on December 2nd. This comes from the U.S. Census Bureau. It's one of their economic indicators alongside that new home sale figure. And this showed that total construction spending reached a seasonally adjusted annual rate of $2.17 trillion. So that is an increase of 0.4% from September and a significant increase year over year of 5%. The even larger number year to date, 7.2% higher compared to the same period in 2023. So some really big sustained growth in the construction sector. And a lot of that is driven by manufacturing and specifically data centers, if you look at the release. So private construction was the one leading the charge. Spending rose to $1.68 trillion. That was up 7.7% from September. And residential construction in particular, an uptick of 1.5%, reaching $934 billion. I know that's a lot of numbers to throw at you, but there's one more I did want to call out. Non-residential construction did actually tick down 0.3% on the month, and it landed at $742 billion. But public construction, on the other hand, was also down 0.5% to $497 billion. There were some declines in some key sectors, education and highway projects. So there's been some big variability in public infrastructure investments, and that was definitely reflected in the release. But overall, total construction pipeline seems to be humming along, but it's asymmetrical, definitely driven by a lot of private investments in some specific sectors. There were some other issues that have popped up. What else have you been watching?
Yeah, I think it was hard to ignore any of the either market commentary or reaction pieces or even just the news itself surrounding what the next administration will bring in terms of policy changes. And one big piece that there is a bit more certainty around is that President-elect Trump nominated Scott Bessent for Treasury Secretary. Mr. Bessent is a longtime macro hedge fund manager, and this nomination was well received by markets on the news. But like so many other policy questions that are floating around now, the actual result or what really comes to fruition is uncertain. But I think what the markets were reacting to is largely based on some of the views and I would say almost guiding principles that incoming Secretary Bessent has laid out. In particular, his 3-3-3 approach to policy. And what that is really referring to is really three core pillars to guide policy. The first being cutting the budget deficit to 3% of GDP. Second being achieving a 3% annual growth rate for the U.S. economy. And the third being increasing U.S. oil production by 3 million barrels per day. And I think these are worthwhile to consider and think through if those are the goalposts. And I think they're quite admirable if you look at it, because if they could be achieved, they really would put the U.S. economy in a very strong position for sustained outperformance, or at least just very competitive positioning at a global level. But these might be a bit harder to implement than just laying out, especially because they do run contrary to some of President-elect Trump's proposed policies, and by themselves, they are quite lofty. So if you just break these down, the bringing the budget deficit to 3% of GDP, that would be pretty much halving the current budget deficit, which floats between 6 and 7%, as well as the 3% annual growth rate. Yes, Atlanta Fed's GDP now is showing that the fourth quarter, we're right on track for that. But overall, if you look at real GDP growth for an economy this large and mature, that 3% annual growth rate is tricky to hit, and not only hit in the short term, but then really sustain it long term. And then the final piece, or the final three, being increasing domestic oil production by 3 million barrels per day. Not going deep into energy markets, I do think that would be possible given the bountiful energy and highly sophisticated energy operators that we have in the U.S. There would likely be some pushback from the operators and the super majors and the majors in that space, given that there already is a bit of a oil and gas glut that is keeping prices down. And so, I mean, maybe if you take all of these together, where if we were humming at this 3% growth rate for long term, or if we would potentially need that, or if we really started opening up exporting, potentially, also, we could really be the battery for the world. But I think these are interesting to think about, but at the same time, I think they are lofty.
Yeah, on a very similar note, President Trump's had a busy past few weeks, and just last week he did post on social media what could otherwise be considered a threat of imposing some 25% plus tariffs on imported goods from Canada, Mexico, and up to actually 60% on Chinese goods. So these are obviously some of the U.S.'s closest trading partners. And if you look at some of the largest categories of imported goods, a majority of the U.S.'s imports. So you also suggested a 100% tariff on BRICS countries that attempted to stray from the U.S. dollar. So there's a lot of implications here for the economy. And I'll get into some specific to commercial real estate in a bit, but I did want to call out some interesting analysis that I came across on LinkedIn. Jason Miller, who is a professor of supply chain at Michigan State University, he posted a nice summary of the estimated tariff shock to producer prices. He posted this on LinkedIn. And so this was a kind of a small chart, but it merged data from across a number of different sources, from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, data on total imports, trade margins, taxes, subsidies, producer prices. Then he layered in U.S. Census Bureau data on imports for Canada, Mexico, and China. And what he found was that, or what the number that he came up with was that there would be a 1.9% price shock from tariffs to all goods, generally speaking, and about the same if you were to even just limit it to manufactured goods. But if you broke this down by category, there was some really big differences, and there was one as high as 5.5% for electronics. And there were some, you know, construction materials, at least manufactured portions. They were pretty high as well. But the kicker to this analysis was actually that he's using existing wholesaler and retailer markups as inputs to the analysis. And there is no guarantee that these manufacturers are just going to stomach these costs and not pass them along to consumers. Sellers obviously need to protect their margins. So there's also no pass-through costs in supply chains in this analysis, fairly crude. So let's say the price of oil goes up and that's passed through to other manufactured goods. That was not part of the analysis. So you could think of that 1.9% figure or 5.5% figure for sort of the baseline of where prices could, price increases or the tariff shock could start. So I thought this is a really interesting analysis. What's the kind of direct angle for CRE? There, in the chart he shared and in some of the analysis, there are direct inflationary impacts on a lot of construction inputs. So prefabricated metals, lumber, construction equipment, vehicles, general energy costs. I think that this, by definition, means that fewer developments will pencil out. This will simply make remodeling more expensive. But I think there's also some sector-specific things to call out here. Were these tariffs to go to be implemented? In the industrial sector, this is going to disrupt supply chains. So either in a what could be perceived as a positive way, if there's more domestic manufacturing, there will be new opportunities for the industrial market, or we'll have to source more from other countries that are not the subject to tariffs. In the retail sector, I think you'll see just the increased price of consumer goods. This could lead to a reduction in consumer spending, some adjustment in retailers' supply chains. And then in the office sector, a little more indirect here, but could be a change in corporate strategy just to adjust for an increase in costs. So definitely some implications there. But also more broadly, these are inflationary pressures. And so this is going to add to market uncertainty. This could complicate the path forward for interest rates, could delay investment, which would impact all property sectors. But we don't know yet. This is going to go through. President Trump likely needs to work with Congress to make some of this happen, because I think this does fly in the face of his previously imposed agreement, the USMCA. And so this runs counter to some of those. So he might have to revise some existing regulations. But on its surface, there are some interesting implications for us here. Seems like would disrupt some supply chains, might be interesting for a few different CRE sectors. Omar, I know that there's a lot of market movements going on recently as a result of some of the stuff we were just talking about, but generally speaking, how about you kick us off with what's happened in the credit markets?
Yeah, I'll quickly run through credit and then I'll spend a little bit longer on equities, particularly because Q3 earnings have largely wrapped up with the exception of some retailers, which you'll be touching on. but we'll start in the credit markets. I would say a broad theme, if I had to put a headline to this, is this is normalization in the come down. What we're seeing really is that everything from the short end of the curve to the long end of the curve, you are seeing downward revisions and downward movements in yields. So starting with the short end, the Fed funds rate, I think the movement down here is really in expectations. So if you rewind and listen to the start of the year, the first episode, start of the year, we were talking 6-7 cuts expected. There's no way for that to happen with one meeting left this year. But we have seen the futures market really price in a revision to how many cuts will be happening through really the next 13 months. So there is one more 25 basis point cut expected this year. And then two 25 basis point cuts are expected through all of 2025. Another movement down over the last couple of weeks has been the yield on the U.S. Treasury security, the 10-year. And that's moved down about 20 basis points to 4.2%. Or in that neighborhood, depending on when you listen to this. And that was after a pretty significant run-up and increased kind of volatility in that space as we were leading up to the election. And then it started to come back down. The combination of this, of generally higher but stabilizing long end of the curve and a falling but gradual short end of the curve, is that the overall curve is normalizing, which it's been inverted for, I don't know the exact day count now, but I want to say, I think this is the second longest period of inversion in history. But another trend of credit coming down, or this might be more staying down, but credit spreads are still historically very tight. And that's pretty much wherever you look across the credit spectrum, you have very tight credit spreads. And there are really two ways of interpreting this move of what's keeping everything so tight. I think the first is that there is a lot of appetite for corporate credit or risk assets, or it's that the overall risk of your benchmark, so this would be treasuries, is actually elevated. I think it's actually a combination of both that's keeping spreads very tight, and the fact that there still is just a lot of capital in the U.S. markets, but also globally. But I think this is certainly something to watch to see what's going to move that is going to be important to understand. And then sticking to credit before I hop over to equities, and I'll bring it to CRE. In November, I think it was a notable milestone for CRE securitizations because they ultimately passed $100 billion in new issuance for the year, and the year's not over. This was driven SASB or single asset, single borrower securitizations, which made up about 60% of that first $100 billion. Another observation is that the agencies remain quite sluggish. Tying it back to kind of policy, I think that agency component does have some potential implications that could be enacted through policy or appointments, but that's still to be seen. All right, I'll shift over to equities. Since we last spoke, Q3 earnings have nearly completed, with the exception of a few retailers that Cole will touch on. But before you do touch on those, I'll provide a few quick stats of kind of overall Q3 results. I would say positive quarter across sectors. Many of the U.S. listed companies really continued to show strong top line revenue growth, as well as bottom line or earnings growth. And really looking at the largest companies that have reported results as of this recording, which is it's on December 2nd, just about half of those that reported, both on revenue expectations, but then also on EPS or earnings growth for the quarter. In terms of sectors, information technology and healthcare had the best results and the most beats on both top and bottom line, while materials, utilities, and utilities sectors had the fewest companies beat, and they also had the most misses in terms of how they stacked up against analyst expectations. Hopping out of the top 500 firms and really focusing on CRE for a bit, nearly all of the U.S. Publicly listed real estate companies have finished their Q3 results. I did a quick analysis of about 191 firms in total. This includes about 35 mortgage REITs, over 130 equity REITs, and then just about 20 real estate service, brokerage, development companies. So in aggregate, about 29% reported both revenue and earning beats for the quarter. Real estate service firms, and this includes brokerage, had the most prevalent upside surprise, with more than half beating analysts' expectations on both top and bottom line. I think you could attribute this to a tick up in volume, in transaction volume, and I would say just revenue activities in the third quarter, but also successful cost management initiatives that they've launched in really starting last year, but have really seen some traction there to support their margins. 39% of all equity REITs as a whole, if you look at the equity REITs together, they beat on both revenue and earnings expectations. There was a wide variance among the different REIT sectors, with 46% of the 13 diversified REITs really posting the most upside surprise. While if you look at the other end of the spectrum, you had both hospitality and industrial sectors really posting the fewest upside surprise to top and bottom line. Overall, the price reaction, so how the shares traded after the results were released, if you look at real estate and listed real estate firms, how they reacted compared to the broad market, real estate firms had this muted response in terms of share price reaction. While real estate companies generally fluctuated about 85 basis points, plus or minus, based on whether they beat expectations or missed expectations, this 85 basis point price movement was compared to 150 basis point movement that was generally seen across non-real estate firms. Finally, I'll touch quickly on overall valuations across the equity markets. So the broad U.S. equity market is currently priced at a 22 times forward earnings, or a forward PE. This is well above the long-term average of about 16 to 17 times. It is nearing its post-pandemic or the most recent peak, which was 23 times in 2021, but it's not quite there. Looking across sectors in terms of the forward PE and how rich certain sectors look, information technology, real estate, and consumer discretionary have the richest multiples, while communications, energy, financials, and utilities are ultimately being traded at smaller multiples. Broadly speaking, I would say the rich valuation that the market as a whole has is driven by a number of themes that are spoken to in the many, many MD&As in their 10Qs, but also in their earnings calls. And those themes are really that there's strong corporate performance in terms of top line growth and protecting margins. There's fading fears of just overall U.S. recession, and there's expected forward growth and expansion of margins and earnings growth be driven predominantly by either efficiency gains and from tech, as well as an overall kind of improved outlook. And so these are all like good themes to be leaving one year and starting a new year with. But the overall pricing of the market as a whole is something that I think a lot of folks will be paying attention to. Can multiples continue to expand, or can the expectations for margins and earnings growth actually meet and justify those multiples that are ultimately pricing the shares today? And before we turn our attention to the year ahead, Cole, can you get us caught up on some of the recent retail earnings and what you were hearing from those management teams?
Yeah, as we approach the holidays, retail is front and center. And so I wanted to call out a couple of things. The first of which is a new article up on the Altus website. That's the five U.S. cities for retail investing that are most likely to outperform benchmarks. So I contributed a few quotes to this article, but I think the theme that I spoke to can help set the stage for the other stuff that we're talking about. And the retail sector has really demonstrated some remarkable resilience. So there's been limited construction following the GFC. We've seen a lot of right-sizing of retail spaces, this shift to experiential, and that's not only counteracted some of the impact of e-commerce, but also made it complementary. So there's in-person experiences that you just cannot replicate online. So we've seen the collapse of a handful of legacy retailers following the pandemic, and this has turned out to be a bit of a generational opportunity for owners to rethink and reposition some of these spaces. Combined with that strong post-pandemic consumer, this has made retail real estate a very increasingly attractive investment opportunity. So one good way to learn about what's going on with some of these retailers is to pay attention to some of their earnings calls. There's some great commentary on consumer spending and the economy. And I took a look at two of them. These are just over a few weeks old now, but I think they're big enough retailers that give a good window into what's happening in the U.S. economy. And the first we'll call a category killer, or Home Depot, so the be-all and end-all department store for home improvement. And they actually released earnings on November 12th. So I like to listen to this one because of its kind of direct relationship to the housing market in addition to commentary on the consumer. They actually outperformed expectations on earnings and revenue. Their sales were boosted by an acquisition of SRS Distribution, in addition to some hurricane-related repairs, warmer than usual weather that spurred some projects. The company raised its full-year sales guidance to reflect stronger than expected performance and the demand from those hurricane recovery efforts. They're projecting 4% annual sales increase, but interestingly, they had a drop in comparable sales, 1.3%. That was the smallest decline in 8 quarters, though. The consumer is fairly cautious. High mortgage rates, high borrowing costs, so they're delaying a lot of these projects. Their call is always interesting. They talk a lot about professional sales, so this is one of the main drivers of their business. They don't just sell to your retail customer in store, but also do a lot to general contractors. So executives on the call said that consumers are deferring a lot of major projects until financing conditions improve, but there is still pent-up demand for home renovation projects for folks who are locked into low mortgages. They also said that housing turnover is stabilizing, inflation is cooling, and so they expect stronger sales on the horizon. One other call that I paid attention to, this was on November 19th, was Walmart's. So the big general merchandiser, they do about 60% of their business is actually grocery. They easily beat analyst expectations. And I want to call out a few numbers because this was fairly remarkable. So I'm comparing these to the Bloomberg consensus estimates, but their revenue was around $170 billion versus the $168 expected. Adjusted earnings per share, 58 cents a share versus 53 expected. Same store sales growth was 5.5% versus 3.81% expected. And foot traffic growth was 3.1% versus 2.82% expected. The ticket on an individual purchase was 2.1%, up 2.1% versus up 1.2% expected. And this is the number that really shocked me. E-commerce sales growth on the year, 22% versus an expected 2.22%. And then lastly, their Sam's Club business, so same store sales growth of 7% versus 4.2% expected. Just some amazing numbers there for how Walmart has been doing in this kind of strange inflationary environment. Again, 60% of their revenue is actually in grocery. They've been a huge beneficiary as an off-price retailer in this sort of strange inflationary period. There were some other data points in here. They were one of the biggest recipients or winners, off-price winners on Black Friday in the U.S. There was some data from Placer AI that said that they had a really strong year-over-year growth relative to Black Friday last year. And Walmart's internal data said that this was uniform across all their different departments. So grocery, clothing, sporting goods, and everything else that they sell. Their stock is up more than 65% year to date. They just seem to be on an incredible tear. Definitely an interesting earnings call. I'll be interested to see what they discuss post-holiday period in their quarter four earnings call. But really interesting stuff. So on a note of Black Friday, this is really interesting. The deals on Black Friday seem to be spreading out. I know anecdotally, I start seeing emails about Black Friday deals well before Thanksgiving. They seem to cover the entire Thanksgiving weekend now. But overall, the sort of in-person experience of Black Friday, I think, is losing its luster. But this year, the holiday was fairly late, so the shopping season is condensed. And I think this has padded some of those numbers for Black Friday. There was a good overview in Retail Dive about some of the Black Friday spending figures. This one was interesting from Block, who runs Square Afterpay and Cash App Card. They say that Black Friday peaked around 2 p.m., and that was across different time zones. And there were some figures from MasterCard's Spending Pulse report that said that sales were up 3.4% compared to Black Friday last year. It's now Tuesday, so we have a little bit of data on Cyber Monday. But Cyber Monday appears to be losing its meaning a little bit as well. Shoppers are using their phones and computers on Black Friday to make headway on holiday lists. Salesforce actually said that online on Friday sales rose 7% on the year to $17.5 billion. And Adobe found that on Black Friday, online sales rose 10.2% to just over $10 billion. And then the last figure here from Adobe was that between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., 11.3 million was spent online every minute. But the last part, I think, was super interesting, that a ton of visits to retailer websites throughout the weekend were actually from AI chatbots. So people using AI chatbots to source comparative deals, and visits to retailer websites, according to those Adobe numbers, was up 1,800% year over year. So I think the kind of meaning of shopping during the holiday season has totally changed. I think AI, and particularly the AI chatbots that can now sort of scrape web pages, have totally changed the game. So I'll be interested to hear what some of these individual retailers said was the impact from the change in Cyber Monday and Black Friday dynamics as we get their kind of next round of earnings calls. But Omar, the holiday season also wraps up the year. And so I think one of the things that we'll be paying attention to is everybody's different outlooks for 2025. What are you looking for as we get to 2025?
Yeah, it's one of my maybe nerdiest, but like I love reading outlooks. I love this time of the year. Often when if you get things that slow down, it gives you the time to actually read these pieces. But often you're looking for similarities and you're looking for differences. I did get a chance to read through a number of the outlooks over Thanksgiving break, and I must say there's real optimism in these. And a handful of the themes that really seem to emerge from the macro views, from whether they're coming from economists, banks, asset managers, investors, or just anybody who has a view and the time to write it up and get it out there. Some of the common themes and expectations for 2025 are easing monetary policy really will continue and will support normalization of yield curves and credit markets and also equity markets. But another common theme was that the U.S. economic strength is expected to continue, and by itself, but then also relative to the global economy, and should ultimately attract global investment. There was a little bit of a divergence around consumer spending. It is expected to cool, but the different outlooks frame that in different ways. But none of them really seem to consider a massive collapse of the consumer or of consumption as a whole. Another common theme had to do with pricing pressures and inflation really remaining sticky. They're not really expected to accelerate quickly. I think that concept of something sticky for a really long time, that I think it either sets a new level or some upward movements might be interpreted as sticky. And ultimately, we don't want to see pricing pressures really return. And then a final theme has to do with that AI point that you were calling out. Pretty much all of the outlooks expect AI spending to increase or at least continue. I would say there was differing views in terms of whether or not the valuations that surround AI will perform, whether they're going to be proven out or if they're going to be pared back a bit and there'll be some sort of correction there. So while these points and themes really help to support this generally positive outlook, there were a number of common questions that seem to be on the collective mind of capital allocators. And those questions include, given the continued robust economic growth and still sticky inflation, how quickly will the Fed cut? What will the prioritization and timing of policy changes be for the new White House administration? And how will these impact specific sectors and the economy as a whole? And will these changes bring back inflation, bring it back into focus? And there are often comments about the labor market, particularly surrounding the essentially proposed expulsory immigration policy. And if that reduces the labor supply, that might tighten the labor market up again, and that may contribute to continued pricing pressures, as well as how will tariffs and any sort of tax changes affect investment as well as consumption. And then the final kind of common question that seems to land across many of the outlooks is what will happen to the U.S. fiscal position and what will the repercussions be for the U.S. dollar, which really has been quite expensive compared to other major global currencies for many quarters. While these outlooks are almost always very high level and the issues they address and really pontificate on, they do impact commercial real estate, but sometimes it's indirectly. Many of the themes and questions raised are ones that we'll likely discuss on future episodes, but bringing specific CRE questions in that I was jotting down throughout these outlooks, the ones that are top of mind for me going into the next year really are, many of these outlooks seem to be taking current trends and really extrapolating them through 2025, but which of these trends will we see either reverse or just stall out? How will the yield curve normalization happen, whether that's via the short end, via the long end moving, and what would the impact really be for commercial real estate? I think this is going to be a big component of really answering the CRE refinance risk question that was top of mind this year. Didn't play out in a super meaningful way, but I think that question rolls over to the next year. And if U.S. equities continue to experience multiple expansion and strong earnings growth, how attractive or competitive will commercial real estate be against other asset classes, equities, but also broader fixed income in the portfolio context? How will the CRE lending landscape shift? Will banks come back or will non-banks and securitization markets pick up the slack, and can they? And of course, which policies that directly affect commercial real estate, whether that's housing policy, banking regulation, or the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, and federal remote work policy affect CRE and specific segments of the market? And then finally, if pricing pressures return, where will they return? In what magnitude will they return? Which sectors of CRE will be able to benefit and pretty much digest those and tolerate it, and which will suffer? So I know I just raised a lot of questions, and that's probably not the ideal way of ending a podcast, but hopefully some of those are either gives you a sense of validation because you're asking the same questions, or you now know that they're on my radar, and these are topics that we'll be diving into in future episodes. But with that, Cole, do you mind letting us know what announcements or what earnings calls can we look forward to in the coming days?
Yeah, there's quite a few earnings calls left to go. So I did want to call out the calendar here for folks if they wanted to pay attention to those. They are later than the rest of the earnings calls because they're shifted to account for the holidays. And so December 4th, which will be before the release of the episode, we have Chewy, Dollar Tree, and Five Below. December 5th, you have Dollar General, Kroger, and Ulta Beauty. December 10th, AutoZone and Academy Sports. And December 11th, Macy's, which has been delayed a bit this year. And then December 12th is a big one, Costco. But those are not the only things going on. Omar, what economic data can we expect in the next few weeks here?
Sure. So this week on the 4th, we get durable goods orders and ADP employment, as well as the ISM is going to be releasing the non-manufacturing PMI index. Then on the 5th, we have the trade balance. On the 6th, we have consumer credit and University of Michigan consumer sentiment data, as well as the employment situation data coming out. And then next week, starting off with wholesale inventories on the 9th, followed by NFIB Small Business Optimism Index. And finally, on the 11th, we get CPI, or the Consumer Price Index data.
I know we got a couple more announcements here. I did want to remind folks that the Investments and Transactions Quarterly Report is up on the Altus website. If you listened to our last episode, we ran through some of the major highlights from that report, which is a new quarterly recurring item on the Altus website. So data in that report covers investment activity through the third quarter of 2024. Would encourage you to check it out, share it with your friends, family, colleagues. Download the full PDF of the report if you want some extra color on some of the items that are there. But if you don't have time to look through the full report, there's been a lot of great summary coverage of it in some of the publications that our listeners probably read. So American City Business Journal, BizNow, Globe Street, MPA Magazine. We'll probably put some links to those on the episode in the show notes. There's also an upcoming article that'll be live on the Altus Insights page that directly leverages data from ITQ. It's going to be a summary of transaction trends and the economic environment during the third quarter. So be on the lookout for that. And then Omar, do you want to tease our upcoming guest episode?
Yeah. So on the next episode, we have a special guest, Shlomo Chop, who's a managing partner at Case Equity Partners. He'll be on the show to discuss one of my favorite topics, which is CRE debt. So look forward to that episode.
Excellent. Omar, I think that's all the time we have today. Before we sign off, I want to share with our listeners how they might be able to give us some feedback on the show. If you want to leave us a message via voice recording, you can check the show notes. There's going to be a link to do so. I would also encourage you to rate or comment on the show the old-fashioned way on your preferred podcast platform. Or feel free to just send us an email at altusresearch@altusgroup.com. We would love to know what topics you'd like covered on the program, especially as you're thinking about what you want to listen to in the new year. In the meantime, thank you all for joining us on another episode of CRE Exchange. We'll be back in a few weeks.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast, powered by Altus Group. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review. And be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate. At Altus, we bring together capabilities across technology, analytics, valuations, tax, and development advisory services. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.